Hello and welcome to Words and Pictures, the show all about the narrative arts scene. I'm your host, S.W. Conser, and we are coming to you today from the Oregon Historical Society, where the Wordstock Literary Festival is underway. And my guest today is an Ignatz Award-winning comics artist and author, best known for her diary comics, which have been collected into numerous books, including the most recent graphic memoir, Everything is Flammable. Gabrielle Bell, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Hello, thank you.
Now, you were born in London, but your childhood was spent in Northern California, Mendocino County, where your mother still lives.
She still lives there, yes.
And, gosh, in the wake of the tragic wildfires that recently swept through California, your new graphic memoir, Everything is Flammable, is really all too timely.
I guess so. Timely. It's too bad.
So, in Everything is Flammable, you have some intense conversations with your mother about your upbringing. Mm-hmm. How would you best describe your mom, part of the kind of second wave feminism, back to the land movement?
Well, it's hard to, it's really hard to sort of sum her up in that kind of way. Not just because she's my mom. I don't think, like, second wave feminists kind of implies liberal arts, college educated, intellectual, middle class. But I mean, at the same time, I'm sure this culture kind of rubbed off on everybody. Yeah, I wouldn't say that, like, I'm sure she was a feminist, but she didn't have this agenda. She was just trying to live a life.
Right, and so you were part of a panel discussion at Wordstock called You Can't Go Home Again, Memoir of the Past and Present, and mother-daughter relationships figured large in that discussion.
Yeah, that was planned that way. It was, I guess we'd all written books about our mothers.
Well, let's see. Your family was definitely caught up in a very particular scene in late 20th century Mendocino County. Cannabis was still illegal, but it was probably the biggest cash crop in the region. And I know your stepdad was part of that industry.
Yes, for sure. A lot of people moved out there to grow pot, and it was a very dangerous way to live. You could lose everything, your property, go to jail. We lived in fear and secrecy. The community was, even though it was so much living in fear and secrecy, it was a lot of pot growers there. Half the industry was pot growing, and then the other half was lumber. And then the lumber died out, and so, nowadays it's just a primarily marijuana industry. But yeah, it is very strange to see how it's come about these days.
What was it like being a kid in that environment? Were you sort of given responsibilities or cautionaries that were kind of beyond what your age really should have required?
Every time a helicopter flew over, it was really frightening. We had to hide. And that was part of my nightmares. There was this, the organization, it was a campaign against marijuana planting. And so they would come with helicopters and big trucks, and the locals would warn each other. And so the plan was, if they would come up, then we would have to put some things in a bag and run off in the woods and hide and hope for the best.
And, of course, this meant that it was hard for you to, I mean, it was really kind of impossible for you to call the police if things went wrong.
Yes, yeah, it was a sort of outlaw society in that way. You didn't call the police about anything, and so, I mean, there was a lot of, like, abuse and a lot of misogyny. I mean, it was a kind of a, I mean, there was a great community of hippies, and there were, but there was also a sort of darker side to it, too, where the hippie movement went wrong, in a way. There was a Bob Dylan quote. He said, "To live outside the law, you have to be honest." Somebody told me that a long time ago, and that seems to be the case. But I don't know if it's really possible to live outside the law. And I don't know if anybody is just, like, a innocent person in that. I mean, like, marijuana in itself is probably a pretty benign drug, but then when it becomes like an industry and a like an outlaw thing, it gets more complicated. It gets mixed up with other drugs that are more frightening and dangerous. Like marijuana itself doesn't cause violence, but the industry and the money will cause violence, the illegality of it.
What was the kid culture like back then, you know, sort of apart from the parents and the grown-ups and what they were doing? What was it like to be a kid growing up in that kind of a rural area without a whole lot of structure?
Well, we were very isolated. There were other kids on the mountain, but they lived a ways away, and once in a while there'd be a party or something, but mostly we were alone. So it was just like me and my three brothers.
Well, you moved away about as far as it's possible to move over to
in the country.
Yeah, at the beginning of the 21st century, you end up living in the Brooklyn neighborhood of Williamsburg. Now it's super trendy, but back then there was still a hive of artists and bohemians there. Mm-hmm. And that's when you started drawing lots of mini comics about your struggles as a young artist. Now, these were not really romantic stories. I mean, you'd be working minimum wage jobs as a teacher, a jewelry maker, mm-hmm. an artist's model, and you and your friends were barely scraping by.
We're still barely scraping by. I mean, yeah, I've got a lot more recognition of my work, but not a lot more money for it. Nowadays, being an artist in New York means making money with your, you know, it's like you're really verging on commercial art. It's hard to be a artist with a capital A or something. But at the same time, it's the greatest. There's so much energy there. There's so much movement, so many interesting people that are coming and going, and this feeling of endlessness is very inspiring. But I started my comics actually in San Francisco. I'd already been doing a lot of mini comics then, but in New York, I think I got more recognition there. Like even just coming, like within a year, like meeting other cartoonists and becoming part of a community there.
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the cartoonist community in Brooklyn.
I think it was probably stronger when it was a bit cheaper to live there. I live near Desert Island Comics, Gabe Fowler's comic book store, which is a really wonderful art comic shop. It stands out amongst all the boutiques, and it's a very original, special place. And right now the Comic Arts Brooklyn Festival is happening, which he puts on every year. I mean, doing that creates a nice sort of scene to rotate around, and there's a lot of different, you know, choices. There's a lot of cartoonists. So yeah, I think there's a fairly good community. We all know each other.
Now, you ended up moving back to Mendocino County for a while to help your mom out, and this is the plot of Everything is Flammable. Tell us how that came about.
Well, I got a call from my mom's neighbor saying that her house had burned down because of a candle had toppled over and caught fire to the sheets. And it was very dry up there in the summer, and as it gets, and the whole house just went up, and my mother barely escaped. I think she just had enough time to put on her pants and her shirt, but she couldn't put on her shoes. And her and her dog ran out and ran across the street, and the neighbors gave her some shoes, and it was really a horrifying thing to hear on the phone when you're across the country, like just thinking of your mom running from the running from a burning building with no shoes on. And I'd been pretty neglectful of my mom over the years, but that kind of was a wake-up call, and I went back there just to help her out. In a way, she didn't really need my help because, you know, she had a sort of community around her helping her. You know, lots of people got together and donated things, household things, and somebody gave her a trailer. And the guy who lives on the property near her helped her a lot with just all the odds and ends. So, in a way, I wasn't even needed, but I think I helped her. It was good for our relationship, and it was probably good for her to have her daughter have a family member at her side.
Well, that's sort of the crux of the story in your graphic memoir, really how you reestablished this relationship as an adult daughter and the conversations you had. And not all of those conversations were easy.
Mm. No, it was really hard sometimes. They never really, I don't know, it's not very resolvable. Sometimes with family and friends, you just have to let things go and just do the best you can. But it was difficult, but at the same time it was very rewarding to be like a team with my mom, you know, driving around buying stuff like a new stove for her new home, negotiating for a house. It was a lot of work and it was good.
Yeah, and at the same time, of course, you've each got your issues. I mean, she's traumatized by the loss of her home, of all of her possessions. And, you know, you in some ways, you had issues that go back to the time before you left for New York.
Yeah, it was a harsh environment there. And I have three brothers, and all four of us, we have a hard time going back there. It was not the most nurturing place. It is kind of squalid, and it was not easy. We didn't have easy childhoods. Aside from that, also, I think even as a kid, I was kind of a city girl. I don't know, like, I always longed to move to the city, and I've always been happy in the city, so even though I grew up in the woods, you know. But it was a really good experience, just being forced to face all of that again.
Did growing up, living by your wits, not being nurtured too closely, not having helicopter parents, did that really help you survive as an artist, to really to be persistent and to not need too much to get by when you struck out on your own?
I mean, that's really hard to say, because it's not like I have a control group. You might just say that anybody who wants to be an artist, they have to make compromises and suffer a little. I mean, it does seem like I have gained a certain kind of toughness and endurance, but who's to say I couldn't have developed in a different way?
Yeah, when you started going overseas, what was your impression about how people in other cultures, well, most notably France and Japan, how they treated cartoonists, how they approached comics?
Well, in America, I think people tend to respect you if you're a success and making money from it. I think in other countries, they will respect you simply because you do it.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm S.W. Conser. And my guest today here at the Wordstock Literary Festival is celebrated comics artist and author Gabrielle Bell, whose latest graphic memoir is Everything is Flammable. Now, you did escape the States for a while. You went on to travel to France and Japan, and that eventually became the basis of the book The Voyeurs.
It was the beginning of the book, Voyeurs, I think, yeah. I was there for a few months, I guess.
You had been taken away from London as a baby, so what was it like to return to Europe?
Oh, I'd been into France a lot. I'd go to festivals a lot, and I went to England a lot of times to stay with my grandmother, so I was pretty familiar with it. Japan was very special. It's a very unusual place. I really liked it. But I was working on a movie. I didn't really get to spend a lot of time taking in the sights, I guess.
Right. In Tokyo, you collaborated with filmmaker Michel Gondry.
Michel Gondry, yes.
And he's probably best known for the film Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Yes.
How did the two of you meet?
We met at a cafe in Brooklyn, and I started teaching his son to draw comics because his son was really into comics. And then we started collaborating, Michelle and I.
Yeah, Tokyo Interior Design was a short film that was adapted from your book, Cecil and Jordan in New York. How did you enjoy that collaboration? Tell me about some of the stories of how that process went.
It wasn't entirely enjoyable, but it was enjoyable. I wasn't used to collaborating. Yeah, it was all very new. It was very exciting to see my comic being portrayed in a film and to see how a film was made. Like, just the nuts and bolts of it. It was eye-opening. Like, we wrote the screenplay and we had a scene where she gets on a bus. So, in a comic, you draw a bus and it's easy. You can look at a picture of a bus and, you know, get the general image. I mean, it was just a thought when we wrote it, a bus, but it turned out very expensive and very complicated. And then I had to learn, like, that bringing a bus into a movie was a big deal. So, it's just seeing how a movie is made really was quite exciting and eye-opening.
Well, there have been a whole lot of adaptations of graphic novels into films over the past few years. And, sometimes the original comics artist is really pleased with the result or just sort of steps back from the results. And sometimes they're just bothered by the lack of control. So is that a process you can understand?
Well, I was very lucky. I mean, I was involved from the very beginning, from writing it to filming it and to editing it. And I didn't get final say, but Michelle really trusted my point of view. And so I'm actually very happy with the movie. I don't think it could have been any better. But, you know, at the same time, I was never particularly interested in making films, so I wasn't invested in it in the way like an aspiring filmmaker would be. So all in all, it was a very lucky and very good experience making that film.
And then you and Michelle Gondry went on to collaborate on an art project, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing this correctly. I believe the title was Kurumu Torumasu?
Close enough. That never actually got finished, though. It got the publisher dropped it. It was never made.
Do you still have some of the artwork from that?
Yeah, I probably do somewhere, I think, in a box somewhere.
When you started going overseas, what was your impression about how people in other cultures, well, most notably France and Japan, how they treated cartoonists, how they approached comics?
Well, in America, I think people tend to respect you if you're a success and making money from it. I think in other countries, they will respect you simply because you do it.
Who are your personal influences? Your work is incredibly expressive, so I'm wondering who some of the other comics artists, designers, or even some of the fine artists were that influenced you when you were younger or even in your adult years.
The cartoonist Julie Doucet was a big influence, and Robert Crumb was, and Dan Klaus, the guys from the 90s, the Hernandez brothers. I was probably very influenced by literature. Like, I loved Thomas Hardy and Henry James and, like, Oscar Wilde. I mean, when I was coming up, and then later on, I just loved Alice Munro. But I think a lot of times, I just love fiction, and I try to put something of that into the comics that I draw, even if they're not fiction.
Yeah, so some of those Victorian and Edwardian authors who were, in some ways, critiquing the society of their time.
Yes, very much so. And very sort of even feminist. Thomas Hardy and Henry James, like, they seem to talk about issues that we are talking about now, in a way.
How so?
I mean, just like the story about the woman who goes off to Europe and she's like, she's independent, but she gets cajoled into marrying some count, and then she's very unhappy. But it's basically about the patriarchy coming down and clipping the wings of this independent free spirit. A lot of Henry James's stories seem to be about that. Same with Thomas Hardy's. They're often about women who are very good and smart, and then they might get knocked up or raped or something, and then their whole society condemns them. And or like Anna Karenina, like a lot of those books seem to me very feminist.
You mentioned Julie Doucet, the Montreal cartoonist. Your work does remind me of her stuff. Yeah, her work is sometimes so surreal. It's almost punk rock in a way. It's all over the place. And sometimes you don't know if she's telling a real story or if she's going off into a dream or a fantasy.
Yeah, I like that about her. I like her world that she creates. She's got a great style.
You're back in New York now, right?
I am, yes.
Can I ask what you're working on right now?
I'm not really working on anything. I'm just kind of just flailing around trying to figure out what to work on next. Well, I did a comic for The New Yorker online. That just came up a couple of days ago. So I've been doing a few short comics here and there. I did something in the summer for the Paris Review online. And I do, like, short autobiographical comics for my Patreon account. But I haven't been able to settle on something to work towards, I guess, like a bigger project. I'm not sure what to do next.
Well, diary comics have been really your specialty and what people have really embraced. Is that something that you're looking to continue, or do you want to expand? Do you want to experiment more, try some new outlets?
I mean, I usually like to use them as a jumping off point. But, yeah, I definitely want to explore something new. I mean, not too new, because I like what I've done, the voice I've created, but I definitely want to find a new direction or something. I want to pare it down more, actually.
Oh, really? You want to be a little bit more minimalist or tighten your stories? How do you want to approach that?
Just more specific, not necessarily minimalist, just more serious. You know, when you're trying to figure out what you're doing, it's hard to be clear about it.
How does drawing make you feel? You know, just the process of drawing, of picking up a pen or a pencil or any tool and just going into that creative space.
Well, it can be very comforting, but it can also be incredibly fraught with anxiety and trouble. So it's just like anything.
Well, the thing about diary comics is they're all about life, and a lot of the autobiocomics that are really fascinating are people who have done a lot of traveling, have done a lot of interesting things, like, say, Robert Crumb or Julie Doucet or Roberta Gregory. And it seems like you've been doing a lot of traveling. You've been doing a lot of adventures. So considering the people that you respect, that's probably making for more interesting comics.
I wouldn't say so. I think great literature is made on mundane things. I think actually the more interesting things are daily life in different places. Like art is about looking at a slice of life, and it doesn't really matter what you write about. It's more about how you write about it. Subject matter is almost secondary, I think. Think about paintings. Like, there's the painting of the peasants resting in the grass after taking a break. Forget it. Van Gogh, I think, or Bruegel. Anyway, it's just a very mundane scene. Or just like a still life of some fruit or a skull, you know. It doesn't have to be big and dramatic.
You're making me think of Marcel Proust with his remembrances of things past. Nothing is really earth-shaking, but he's bringing back these memories with such loving detail.
Well, I think everybody's life is actually incredibly earth-shaking. Like, everybody falls in love. and that's earth-shaking. Everybody experiences all kinds of dramas in their life, death and tragedy and terrible things, and also wonderful, exciting things. So I think that's earth-shaking enough.
Well, the book is Everything is Flammable. The author is Gabrielle Bell. Gabrielle, I'm delighted that you could join us today on Words and Pictures.
Thank you very much. It's been a good time.
Now, for our listeners who might be interested in your various projects, how can people find out more?
Could go to my website is www.gabriellebell.com, GABRIELLEBELL.com.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and at KBOO.FM. I'm your host, S.W. Conser. You can find an archived version of this show later today at KBOO.FM/Words and Pictures. And be sure to follow us on Twitter @WordsAndPicture.